Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 26, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleform conference call. Today we'll be discussing today's same-sex marriage case resolved today by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I want to, at the outset, thank both of our guests for joining us. They're both return guests. We appreciate them being here. We'll hear first from Ilya Shapiro. He's the Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, and he'll be followed in opening remarks by Professor John C. Eastman. He's the director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University, Dale E. Fowler School of Law. And there's always one title for you, Professor Eastman, that we neglect, and I think it has to do with Claremont.
Oh, yes, I'm the founding director of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which coincidentally was involved as counsel of record in two of the amicus briefs in this case.
Very good. So we'll hear first from Mr. Shapiro. He's going to give us 5 to 10 minutes in opening remarks, then Professor Eastman. And a note at the outset, we only have Ilya Shapiro for the first 30 minutes of the call, so we'll be turning to questions after these opening remarks, and we'll try and give Mr. Shapiro as much time as possible during the first half of this program, and Professor Eastman will be with us for the entire 60 minutes. But with that, Mr. Shapiro, your opening thoughts.
Sure. Well, I think everyone expected on both sides what was going to happen, not necessarily today, although June 26th is the day apparently for gay rights, because Lawrence and Windsor were also decided on June 26th. So 5-4, Justice Kennedy for the majority, joined by the so-called liberals, saying that there's a constitutional right for gay and lesbian couples to get marriage licenses, at least so long as everyone else gets them. My personal position is I question why government's involved in marriage in the first place, but anyhow. A little unclear why that is, and that's also Kennedy-esque. Clearly under the 14th Amendment, we know that much. Clearly both the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause do the work to get there, not clear exactly how. Something like there's a fundamental right to be with the one you love, and to have the state recognize that, if they recognize it, if they have this institution, and it violates a constitutional principle of equality to deny that right on the basis of sexual orientation, or that the state doesn't have any other strong enough reason to draw its licensing regime in the way that it does. Often soaring rhetoric by Kennedy, as we expect, a lot of discussion of the facts, the people involved. The kind of technocratic legalese about standards of review and scrutiny and that sort of thing, which I kind of appreciate, because that's kind of a technical artifice anyway that bifurcates or trifurcates our rights. Unclear what we do with this exactly, in terms of, is the court saying that you can never discriminate based on sexual orientation, or what a good enough reason is, or is marriage just unique, a unique type of institution? We don't really know, but we do know that denying marriage licenses on the basis of sexual orientation violates the 14th Amendment. And it's interesting that the four so-called conservatives dissented, and each one wrote separately, which is very interesting. I haven't gone through all of the dissents, but they seem to all be riffing on the same basic point. John will go into this in more detail, that this isn't a decision that should be made by judges. As Chief Justice Roberts concludes, you can celebrate this opinion, you can glory in it, you can celebrate the availability of new benefits or expression of commitment to a partner, but don't celebrate the Constitution. It has nothing to do with it. Now, I think he would have a lot more credibility in saying that had he not ruled and written the way he did in the Obamacare cases, but I guess that's by the by. And you know, Alito has some very good language. I mean, it's they sort of, in my view, ultimately why I side with the Kennedy side, although not I wouldn't have written it necessarily the way that Kennedy had, is that the dissenters, to me, sort of beg the question. That is, well, yes, the states get to decide, except when they violate individual rights. So are they violating an individual right here? And that obviously is the point of contention. turn it over to John.
Thanks very much. Obviously, not an unexpected, but nevertheless a very disappointing decision. I think Chief Justice Roberts' principal dissent, I think, characterizes it. He says, the majority's decision is an act of will, not legal judgment. The right it announces has no basis in the Constitution or this court's precedent. And then the kind of overarching theme of all four of the dissents is the arrogance of the court in taking an issue away from the people. And Roberts, I think, captures that as well. The court invalidates the marriage laws of more than half the states and orders the transformation. See, we're not just talking about an extension, but the transformation of a social institution that has formed the basis of human society for millennia, from the Kalahari Bushmen and the Han Chinese, the Carthaginians and the Aztecs. Just who do we think we are? I think that theme, just who do we think we are, or you know, you might put in the less judicious language, who the hell do we think we are, is kind of at the core of the thing. The notion that the 14th Amendment, in drafting the drafters of the 14th Amendment, or those people who ratified it, when they put in that sweeping language of, you know, protection of life, liberty, and property without due process of law from infringement against the state, would mandate the redefinition of a core social institution that is both religiously and biologically grounded, is just surreal beyond belief. And yet Justice Kennedy, in language that really doesn't focus on whether it's due process or equal protection, he can't seem to get the two, but if we stick them together in this confluence of it, it offends dignity not to have, I guess, not to have the state lay its hands on your relationship and give it the benefit of its approval. Because nobody was interfering with the right of any two people to engage in whatever kind of conduct they wanted. We're talking about the obligation of the state to confer on your decisions and how you engage in personal conduct the state's judgment of its approval. And if that's what the institution of marriage is about, well, then as Justice Roberts point out, why is it limited to two? Why are all the other restrictions that are longstanding on marriage going to survive this newfound right of the court unless five members of the court decide not to? And it's that issue that all four of the dissenters point out, that when we get unmoored from the text, the history and traditions that inform the text, the legal authority that gives primacy to that text, of those who ratified it and what they had in mind, then we're completely unmoored. None of them cite Lincoln, but Lincoln's first inaugural address, I think, here is very apt, that if we think that the judgment of five members of the court settle contested social policy issues like this and take them away from the people, we will cease to be a self-governing people and will have instead handed over governing authority to that unelected body. So this is now, I think, a case that's emblematic of a much bigger fight than same-sex marriage. But on the utter supremacy of the court to decide questions that for which there really is very little constitutional basis for it. And I think the way Ilya described Justice Kennedy's opinion and the difficulty of pointing out just what the legal analysis is, I think highlights the concern expressed by all four of the dissenters.
Very good. I'm going to get right to the audience questions. We've got almost 300 people on the call already. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, let me remind folks that Monday is another decision day of the Supreme Court with three big cases yet to be decided, the Michigan versus EPA case, the Glossop death penalty case, and the Arizona redistricting case. So next week we will have also a call on yesterday's Texas redistricting case, Texas housing case rather. But probably also cover each of the three cases I've just mentioned. It's sort of a fluid schedule, so you'll need to check the website and monitor your emails. Today, of course, the gay marriage case. Let's now take our first call.
Good morning, Bob Zadig.
Yeah. Go right ahead, sir.
Good morning, Ilya. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I agree with a lot of what was said, but I think the commentary, or I suggest the commentary, kind of misses the point a little bit. the Supreme Court in endorsing as a right gay marriage focused on the word marriage. The word marriage is, in this context, is not describing an emotional relationship, but rather a state-created, rather huge package of property and other rights. So the Supreme Court, so the problem is marriage has morphed from a personal relationship to a legal status with certain property and tax benefits. And when you look at marriage solely in that context as being a package of property rights, the decision starts to make, in my mind, the majority decision, a little more sense than rather merely a statement on an emotional relationship.
Yeah, this is John. I disagree with that. I think it's because of that that it actually makes less sense. Because we have to ask the question, and from Ilya's perspective, the state has no business being involved in marriage in the first place. And if it's just about laying your hands on people and conferring the state sanction of your relationship, I agree with that. So we have to ask the question, why is it that our nation, our states, and in fact every other nation in human history has gotten involved in the marriage business? It's not to confer their hands on a relationship. It's to encourage a particular family structure that is optimal for the raising of the children that are the result of the one sexual union that can produce them, that of a man and a woman. That's the reason the state got involved in the business at all. It's the reason it has all sorts of benefits that go along with that institution, because that's the way you induce people to enter into that cultural institution, to limit yourself in your extramarital affairs, to take responsibility for the children that are the natural offspring of that union. And that's the only reason the state had any business being involved in marriage in the first place. If we redefine the institution to be something about something entirely different, and Justice Kennedy does this, this is an opinion, this is the arrogance of the opinion, that the fundamental character is about all these benefits and the package and the conception of dignity that flows from it, and with respect to all of that, there's no difference between same and opposite sex couples. Well, that's the core question. Is that the reason the state got involved in the business of marriage in the first place? And when it's evident that it is not, then what Justice Kennedy has done here is something rather extraordinary and quite beyond the role of a judge.
Well, I think, John, you're conflating natural law, marriage under natural law or even common law, with state marriage licensing regimes, which are fairly new. I mean, even though marriage itself is millennia old, state government licensing regimes are about 150, 200 years old, and they were put in for various reasons, for registration schemes, for taxation schemes, to protect the rights of women and couverture and all these other different things. But we don't need, I mean, it's a separate issue of whether the state should be involved at all, but that's what's at issue in this case, not whether a community or a society should recognize and encourage the stability of unions for the that generate children and all the rest of it. Sure, that's probably right, but when we're talking about the licensing regimes, the court was looking at why restrict it in this certain way. Does it harm other marriages? Does it, you know, what is the compelling interest? And that's where the states came up short. So I don't think it's a matter of the notion of marriage has changed from a relationship to the bundle of rights. I agree with you there. I don't think that's what's going on here. But it's we've come to understand, not that the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment contemplated gay marriage, but that the meaning of equality means certain things. And when there is no justified reason for drawing an institution, a state law in a certain way, then it has to fall away.
Well, but Justice Kennedy doesn't take up the reasons that are offered by the court and reject them, and the notion that it is illegitimate for the people to adopt an institution or to retain an institution of marriage that is tied to that unique biological ability of men and women, because it furthers a purpose that no other sexual union furthers, and it's a purpose that is of unique benefit to society. In fact, to use the language the Supreme Court used way back in Loving versus Virginia, they treated marriage as fundamental because it's essential to our very existence and survival. That's not true for other adult relationships that now want to have the state state's blessing of dignity on their relationship. You know, that's bunk that the state has any interest whatsoever in doing that. In fact, quite frankly, as Justice Thomas points out in his dissenting opinion, it's really contrary to the Declaration of Independence. We don't get our dignity from the state. And the notion that, the only way your relationship can be dignified is if the state lays its hands on it ought to send libertarians running for the hills. Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion points that out. So we're back to the main question: why do we have the institution of marriage? Why did state get involved in it? And it's not to confer dignity on all sorts of adult relationships. The danger that will flow, I think, will be profound, because exactly the same arguments that were just made, that there won't be any harm to the institution of marriage and to other people's marriages, were made 50 years ago on no-fault divorce. Let's remove the permanence norm of marriage to let people that are in rough marriages get out of them earlier. Well, how will that affect your marriage or even the institution of marriage? Those exact same arguments were made, and people that said it will have profound consequences on it were laughed out of the room. Well, it turns out they were prescient. That 50 years later, we know you remove the permanence, you shift a little bit from it being child-centric to adult-centric, and then you hit a rough spot in your marriage, and you say, I'm no longer getting fulfillment out of this marriage. It's no longer a permanent institution that I committed to, so I'm out of here. And what has been the result? Massive number of kids now raised in households without both of their biological parents, and the risk of developmental and social harms to them are profound. Well, we're now going to remove even more profoundly important aspects of that cultural norm of marriage: the biological diversity, the fact that parents are connected to their natural children as a result of this institution, all of that, and to think, as Justice Kennedy says, that it's not going to have any consequence whatsoever is just beyond credible. And yet he has now fashioned himself as the philosopher king who's going to decide these questions that are clearly not decided by the Constitution, unless you have this infinitely expanding and evolving notion that the Constitution is whatever five members of the court decide it to be on any given day.
We've got.
Should we take another caller?
Yeah, we've got quite a few questions pending, so let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, Larry Callahan, sadly from California, directs this question to Mr. Prescient, Professor Eastman. I think the last couple of answers directed to some of this, or leads to some of this. Obviously, the state of California, the government or whatever, city, county governments are being involved in now the marriage process. What does that do for an argument that there's someone's going to come and file like the wedding cake lawsuits that would attempt to require a Catholic church or any other church to perform a gay wedding?
Well, several of the dissents raise this issue.
I would say I haven't read the dissent.
No, that's right. I'm sorry.
Question,
I'm
guess.
Yeah, so I'm going to summarize them. And Solicitor General Verrilli kind of laid down the marker in oral argument back in April. He was asked by Justice Alito if we mandate same-sex marriage as a matter of constitutional law, what will become of a religious university that has married student housing? Will they be obligated to accommodate that same-sex couple in their married student housing, even though it runs against a fundamental tenet of their faith? And Verrilli basically said yes, or risk losing your tax exempt status. He didn't say it so boldly, but that was the clear implication of his response, that yes, that will be an issue that we will be looking at. And several of the dissenting opinions point that out. Justice Kennedy's response is that, of course, we'll still have religious liberty. But the religious liberty he describes is not the freedom to exercise your religion by, in fact, adhering to its tenets in the public square, but the freedom to hold that belief as long as you want, as long as you keep it private and in the privacy of your home or your church or synagogue. This is not the religious liberty that our founders envisioned. And the conflicts between this newfound constitutional mandate and the exercise of religion by anybody who dares to actually implement their faith in their public life is going to be constant and profound. We've already seen it happening.
So, John, what you're saying, it's a slippery slope from housing, which I think is a different era, to someone telling the church they've got to perform the ceremonies.
Well, that's right. And people keep saying, oh, it's never going to affect the church directly. Well, we've already seen it affect the church indirectly. If you're Catholic Charities and have a view against homosexuality that it's contrary to the faith, you're not going to place children in a homosexual household. you're no longer going to be able to perform adoption services. So Catholic Charities has shut down in Massachusetts and in Illinois and in Washington, D.C. If you enter into a public business and say, I'm happy to sell you a cake, but I'm not willing to help you celebrate a ceremony that violates my faith, well, you're hauled before the Human Rights Commissions and you're fined and you're ordered to go into sensitivity training. And then if you're a for-profit chapel up in Idaho that not just rents your chapel, but also rents the services of the minister to perform the wedding, you're now obligated to do so. And so the notion that it's not going to reach into the pulpit is just false. We've already seen it happen, and it will happen much more broadly. Churches and their collateral nonprofit parallel organizations will be threatened with the loss of their nonprofit status if they don't get in line with the new mandate.
Well,
look. This is just talking about a different kind of slippery slope. You have to decide the case that's in front of you, and just like I don't buy the slippery slope that you allow gays to marry, and pretty soon, you know, XYZ parade of horribles. Similarly, just because you decide the case this way doesn't mean that you necessarily have to do all of these other things and force bakers to bake cakes and priests to marry people that they don't want to marry and all the rest of it. And John, you know, some of these cases, if and when they come up, I think we've already been on the same side and we'll continue to be so. But at the end of the day, this is about, I'm not going to, fall for having to defend Kennedy's opinion and the reasoning such as it is. But in general, I think it's fairly clear to me that it's not the intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment that matters here, but what is the meaning of equality under the law? And that means that if the government does not have a sufficient justification for treating different people differently or restricting or drawing an institution in a particular way, then it simply cannot hold. And if that raises the questions of why government is involved in marriage in the first place, or then so be it. That's I welcome that debate even more.
So the question, and I think Elia's focus on the issue, under traditional equal protection analysis, we ask, does the government have a legitimate purpose for making the classification? Perhaps unique, but tied to that purpose is what the purpose of the institution is. And so the equal protection analysis is barely evident in the opinion at all.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. But to the extent it's there, he makes the point that there's no legitimate government purpose. But to say that means that Kennedy is already in his own mind redefined the understanding of marriage away from the historical purpose to a new one. It's about the dignity of the relationship of the adults rather than the structuring of that adult relationship for the benefit of the children that result from it. And there's no there is not a word in our Constitution, in the understanding of equality, in the understanding of liberty, that answers that question. And it's that question that he has now taken away from the people because, in his judgment, they just for millennia have been getting it wrong. And what a level of arrogance from a justice who can say none of that matters, not just religious faith, but basic reason and biology and our human nature, throw it all to the wind because dignity, in my mind, ought to prevail.
Well, let me put it this way. If there's a regulation about urinals, the angle that they have to be drawn, I'm sure this is coming down from OSHA or the EPA or somebody at some point to minimize splatter or what have you. Just because you have that regulation doesn't mean it has to be thrown out as an equal protection violation because women don't use urinals. Marriage, there's no, gay people can enjoy the fruits of marriage and the benefits they're under, and if they, don't produce children, that's fine because there are other purposes to marriage as well. If this was just about kids, then we would have strengthened laws about custody and child support, and you have to stay with your spouse once you produce children, no-fault divorce for spouses with children or something like that. But marriage itself, whether it's, I think it's, you're correct, it remains in Kennedy's mind. It's not spelled out. how the equal protection analysis exactly works. The closest that comes here is in page 19 of the slip opinion, where he says the due process clause and the equal protection clause are connected in a profound way, though they set forth independent principles. Rights implicit in liberty and rights secured by equal protection may rest on different precepts and are not always coextensive, yet in some instances each may be instructive as to the meaning and reach of the other. In particular case, one clause may be thought to capture the essence of a right in a more accurate and comprehensive way, even as the two clauses may converge in the identification and definition of the right. I mean, that, there's a lot that's not fleshed out there, unfortunately, but
yeah,
I think...
It's utter nonsense. It doesn't mean anything.
It means that there is a fundamental right, or it's an important freedom to live as a couple with the partner of your choice, and that's under the due process clause.
And nobody was blocking that.
And it's an equal protection violation to deny the legal aspect or recognition to that, without some greater justification.
Well, that's right. And Justice Thomas, I think, takes up that issue very adequately and persuasively in his dissent. He said our understanding of liberty and even in the amalgamated version with equal protection overlay has always been about government not restricting you in your conduct or your actions, not about forcing government to give you certain benefits. And so they've now turned this negative protection against government intrusion on your rights to a demand that government must sanction and must provide benefits, even though it provides not the benefit that government got involved in the institution in the first place.
So are you going to join with me and say the Institute for Justice in its next occupational licensing suit against the institution of marriage?
Well, no, because I think the society does draw immense benefits from the institution of marriage as it's been understood. In its new model, it doesn't provide those benefits because we've now made the institution about something entirely different that is beyond the capacity of government and beyond the benefit to any government to decide. What conceivable benefit does government get by laying its hands on any adult relationship and saying, we give you approval for it?
I shouldn't need a license to get married. Exactly.
Well, but by channeling men and women to engage in procreative conduct within an institution where they are committed to each other and a lifelong commitment to, or at least long enough until the kids are out of the house, to ensure that there are immense societal benefits that flow from that. And so if we're going to have an institution of marriage, we ought to focus on what it is that the society benefits from, why we have government involved in it. If that's not what it's about, then we ought to just abolish the institution altogether. But I'm not willing to do that because I think there are immense benefits to society from keeping that long-standing cultural norm rooted in our nature and rooted in biology.
Well, let's take another question from the audience, see if we can stir up some controversy between the
two. Yeah, we haven't had any yet.
Hi, my name is Christopher. I was just curious, guys. You know, the four requirements of marriage have been in place for a long time. One, of course, meaning it's between two people, no more, meaning no polygamy. Two, no minors can get married, meaning you have to be of age. Three, people cannot be related, meaning no incest. And four, they have to be between different genders. Now, this court has just ruled that number four can be eliminated, but they want to keep one, two, and three in place. And by the way, the ruling also states that procreation cannot be considered because, as we all know, between two males or two females, procreation is impossible. How does this not lay the groundwork for polygamous or incestuous relationships who meet the other three, and when procreation has nothing to do with it, how does this not lay the groundwork for their argument?
Well, on the reasoning, it clearly does lay the groundwork. On their exercise of raw will, it may not, because they may choose not to take that step. And so to go back to Ilya's, I think, correct criticism of slippery slope type of arguments, you've got to be careful of them. But the way you assess whether the slippery slope is likely is to look at the reasoning and see if there's anything in the reasoning that would prevent those slippery slope type of things from coming up. And not only is there nothing in the reasoning that would prevent that from happening, but in fact the reasoning all but compels it if they're consistent with their reasoning when the next case comes to their door.
Okay, I'm going to say this, and then I have to actually jump off. I apologize, but The issue of minors has to do with consent. So if there's consenting adults, that's what the issue there. There has to be some justification somewhere. So there's apparently new research about what incest means, and first cousin marriages really aren't statistically greater chance of having a birth defects or whatever the old justification was, so maybe that could fall away. But again, you have to look at the rationale. Is there consent for with polygamy? Is there going to be coercion? I mean, there are certain other issues that come into play with numerosity that don't come into play with opposite sex. So again, it comes down to what is the state's justification, and is that strong enough to overcome the presumption that if it treats people differently, then that it can't do that. Anyway, I apologize that I have to jump off. Anyone can feel free to contact me at Cato if they have more questions. I'm sure I'll be writing about this in coming days.
Well, I would like to just jump in because his argument that incestuous relationships should be banned because of procreation and what it might breed, the Supreme Court has just ruled that procreation has nothing to do with marriage. Because as I mentioned previously, between two males and two females, procreation is impossible. So procreation, or the ability to have children, has nothing to do with the definition of marriage. And now the caller that just jumped off said, well, we should consider procreation and the possibility. The Supreme Court just said, no, that has nothing to do with it.
That's right. And that's why these cases are already coming. There's already a case in Utah challenging Utah's anti-polygamy statute, which, of course, has a rather unique history in our nation. And what Justice Kennedy has said is the right to marry whomever you want is a fundamental right. To deprive you of that violates your liberty interests under due process and your equal protection, or some amalgam of the two.
Right, John, because the first caller mentioned the 10th Amendment, due process, and the 14th Amendment, equal protection. Every single class that you're discussing, incestuous or polygamous, meet those requirements.
That's right.
So
that's right.
this is a very dangerous slippery slope.
No, that's right. And because he's now found it to be a fundamental right, then it's hard to see what kind of compelling interest. Even age of consent laws are, I think, very susceptible to challenge. Because, for example, in the abortion context, we have treated girls as young as 12 or 14 as having sufficient maturity to make a fundamental decision for their own about whether to get an abortion without any involvement or even notification of parents. Well, if they have enough ability to consent to that, then surely they have enough ability to consent to a marriage. And restrictions on their liberty as a 12 or 14-year-old to marry a 25-year-old ought not to be countenanced because it's a fundamental right. And if a bisexual can only find fulfillment and dignity by having a partner both at the same time of one of each sex, then how can the court stand in the way, or how can any state have a restriction on that relationship or polyamorous relationships? If the only way I can find fulfillment is having multiple sexual partners all living under the same roof, then how can the state interfere with that liberty? Because it's a fundamental right to decide my autonomy on that. Now, Justice Kennedy, several times in opinion, says it's about two people. But there's nothing in the logic or reasoning of his opinion that limits it to two people of same sex without raising these other issues. And if you follow the logic of the opinion, to the extent there's any logic of the opinion at all of those longstanding restrictions on marriage have to be called into question. And the notion that the Constitution language adopted and ratified in 1868 has already decided that issue for us, even in its evolving terms, is a level of arrogance by the court that threatens to unravel the very nature of the rule of law. And that's however profoundly important destroying the social institution is going to be, that may well be even more profound consequence of this decision.
Let's go to another caller now.
But I don't have any distinct views on the subject.
Good afternoon. I am one of the persons who would have almost certainly voted for expanding marriage to same-sex couples in a referendum, but you know, I just am appalled by this opinion taking the right away from the states to do so. I think the last answer just kind of answer the other question I was going to bring up, but do you have any further comments on how the court is, as it did with Roe versus Wade, decided that the states just weren't moving fast enough, notwithstanding that just less than 30 years after Bowers v. Hardwick, we have 11 states that have gone through the democratic process to implement gay marriage, either by referendum or more commonly by legislation.
Yeah, no, very good question. And, of course, Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion takes that up. He professes agnostic views on whether we ought to have same-sex marriage or not. I suspect he has a particular view on that, but in his role as judge, he doesn't think it has any play in his constitutional analysis, and he's right about that. I tend to disagree with him on the front end. I would not support a change in that because I think it kind of ignores the reason we have the marriage institution in the first place. And if you make this change, you're going to have people questioning, why is society involved in the institution at all? Let's just get rid of it. And if you get rid of it, all of the benefits that have flowed to society from that core institution are going to be harder to come by. But to redefine it as if our basic human biology no longer matters and is irrelevant to this core social institution, I think is a very dangerous thing. But the notion, and you're absolutely right about this, even if we said the states ought to be able to experiment in crazy ideas, let's redefine it, let's make it plural marriage, let's make it, drop it to age of 12, let's let brothers and sisters, as long as they're consenting, or mothers and sons, or mothers and daughters, as long as they're of the age of consent, let's keep that off the table for a moment. All of those threats to the kind of core family structure, if states want to experiment under Justice Scalia's view, they can, but there's no requirement in the Constitution that they must do so. And the notion that the Constitution has already settled this is dangerous because now what you're going to do is the same thing you did with Roe versus Wade. You're going to lock in the contending forces. You're going to make it impossible to reach accommodations. This is why the threat to religious liberty is going to be much more severe and profound now than it would have been if we had adopted these through the democratic process, because in the states that have adopted them, there's been some accommodation made, which carries with it the weight of law in a way that this new constitutional dictate won't. And you're going to find a real cultural conflict now that particularly if you believe the polls and the American people are shifting on this issue, was completely unnecessary. But the democratic process ought to let us sort those questions out. And remember, just last year, Justice Kennedy said that it's beneath the dignity to the democratic process and the American people to take issues on contested social policy away from them. He said that in the Schuette case, in the Michigan affirmative action case. He must have forgotten he wrote that just 12 months, 14 months ago.
Let's move right along. We've still got quite a few questions pending, Professor, so let's take another call.
What's the standard of review now for marriage? Because we do, of course, have restrictions on marriage, three people, four people, minors, incest, and so on. Is it going to be strict scrutiny? Is it rational basis review? And I'm asking in particular because whatever this right was that was announced today, it's going to go up against First Amendment religious freedom. And so if it's a rational basis review new constitutional right against religious freedom, you would think the presumption at least would be that religious freedom would come out on top.
Well, it's hard to say. The opinion is noteworthily muddled on standards of review and the normal things that we look at in constitutional adjudication. There's language in there that it's a fundamental right, and that the fundamental right is not as it's ever been throughout human history, but a fundamental right based on these new understandings. Well, the only thing that limits the court from applying strict scrutiny in a polygamy statute or a age of consent statute or a degree of consanguinity statute would be just its raw will. We're saying, well, we don't think that one constitutes the fundamental right as we envision it in the way that the last one did, so we're not going to go there. It's completely unmoored from any principle on how to decide the like cases that are likely to come next. And that's what's most frustrating to the dissenters, that this why they say this is just an exercise of raw will, not of legal judgment, and therefore beyond the role and the authority of the court, and really a claim of judicial supremacy that amounts to a usurpation of power. That's the language that the dissenters use, and I think they're absolutely correct in their choice of language there.
Lisa Garcia, FOIA Resource Center, thank you for your comments so far. My bigger question is to step back from the specifics of this opinion. What is our remedy constitutionally for a court that is acting a lot like the one we had in the late 60s with the Burger Court, the activist court? I mean, when we have judicial nullification of legislative statutes, what do we do?
Yeah, it seems to me that there are three remedies, and we can explore them. There are benefits and challenges or dangers with each one of them. One remedy is the remedy that was kind of put in place after Roe versus Wade, which was a strategic political remedy to choose a new president who was pro-life, who would in the fullness of time have judicial appointments, who would reorient the court back toward a proper understanding of its role, and it would reverse that decision. That's now been 42 years and hasn't succeeded yet. One thinks that it's on the cusp of success, but it's hard to say. The other remedies flow out of the Dred Scott decision, and both of them are there. The first and more evident one, constitutional one, is for either Congress or the states to initiate a constitutional amendment that would overturn this erroneous Supreme Court decision, this erroneous and illegitimate Supreme Court decision. The third and starker remedy, also out of that era, is the one I referred to earlier, and it's the one Lincoln references in his first inaugural address, that the Supreme Court is supreme with respect to the case it decided, and therefore that judgment has to prevail with respect to the parties before it. But if we're going to treat it as binding precedent, settling the contested issue forevermore for all the other branches of government, then we will have ceased to that extent to be a self-governing people, and we'll have handed over governing authority to that unelected body. And so Lincoln's invitation there, which he implemented as president, was not to comply with the ruling in other cases that were not directly before the court. And I suspect that there will be some in some states who overwhelmingly reaffirmed man-woman marriage in relatively recent years that will take that strategy as well. And it's that Justice Scalia closes his opinion with, that when the court is embarked upon this kind of exercise of raw will rather than legal judgment, that it calls into question the very legitimacy of the court, and eventually people are going to grow tired of just following its dictates because the court said so. And Justice Scalia sends a warning shot across the bow of the court that you may have invited that kind of just lack of regard for this court's opinions because you are so unmoored from the authority that the people have given to you in the Constitution. So those are the three potential solutions before us. Obviously a constitutional amendment is an uphill battle, but I remind people that only 11 states have changed their marriage laws by popular vote or legislative judgment. And even in one of those, New York, for example, the legislators that went back on their pledges in their campaign lost their next elections as a result of their shift in vote on this issue. But 39 other states did not make that change, and it only takes 38 to get a constitutional amendment through. So the notion that a constitutional amendment is an impossibility, I think, is not necessarily true, although it would take a concerted effort. But I think that, combined with the political effort to put a president in office who's committed to defending man-woman marriage, and judges who would understand their proper role, which is not to substitute their will for the will of the people on contested policy issues like this, I think both of those can go on simultaneously.
Let's move right along.
This is Gerald McLaughlin in New York. To turn the discussion beyond the immediate context of marriage, the Chief Justice refers to the majority opinion as having effectively overruled Glucksberg, Washington v. Glucksberg, which he describes as the leading modern case setting the bounds of substantive due process. Do you think he's right? To what extent is that the case? What potential for future mischief does that mean?
Well, I do think he's right, and Justice Alito raises the issue in his dissent as well, that the reason Glucksberg is such a profoundly important decision is because the court recognizes when you define something as a fundamental right that's not enumerated in the text, that you take issues away from the democratic process, and you allow the court to substitute its judgment for that of the American people. That's a very heady and dangerous temptation for the court. Justice Alito says, we've now seen that, after decades of trying, that we're incapable of not succumbing to that temptation. Well, what does that mean? That means the court becomes ultimately political. It's going to decide political disputes rather than legal ones. That means that the nomination process is going to become even more overtly political than it has, because it matters not what your judgment is, how practiced you are in the exercise of that judgment and the application of law, but what your answer on the contested political questions of the day is going to be. And therefore, we have no reason why we should have an independent judiciary. And this goes back to the closing line in Justice Scalia's opinion. We have brought on ourselves a threat to the institution, because when we're making political judgments, why should people hand off the political judgments to us nine and take it away from the 50 million that voted the other direction? We have no legitimate basis for making that claim when we're unmoored from the higher authority that the Constitution gave us. And so that's, I think, the real danger inherent in this. And Chief Justice Roberts is right to focus on Glucksberg, because it was the Glucksberg opinion and the analysis on how we go about defining, or being humble about defining, new constitutional rights that keeps that that temptation in check, and it's now gone.
But do any immediate does any immediate potential for mischief occur to you? Are there any issues percolating out there where this would give encouragement to people to pursue the substantive due process argument?
Well, I do think there will be a lot. I think there'll be a lot dealing with other sexual orientation type claims. I think we'll see various transgendered claims coming out. We've already seen some legislation offering rights to use bathrooms of the opposite sex if you feel like you're a member of that sex. But in areas where those aren't getting through legislatively, I can see substantive due process claims flowing out of my dignity and my autonomy type of liberty interests that are directly out of Justice Kennedy's opinion. I can certainly see the polygamists and the age of consent and all those other things giving rise to such claims as well. They're much more directly related. But you know, when the problem is, you know, how far this would go is just a function of one's own imagination, because it is so unmoored from either the Constitution's text or any longstanding history and traditions that kind of developed a proper understanding of what indeed is fundamental. And for the courts to then be completely unmoored for it, the only thing that stands in their way is their own sense of self-restraint. And as we see, power doesn't beget self-restraint very often when the power is unchecked.
If you joined us late, we're talking about today's same-sex marriage decision in the Supreme Court. One of our experts, Ilya Shapiro, had to leave the call early. We've still got Professor John Eastman. We're in the Q&A portion here. If you have got a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few minutes left and three questions in our queue, so let's carry on.
Professor, this is Paul Jensen from Newport Beach, California. And I'd like to push you a little further on one of your proposed remedies or possible remedies in the area of religious liberty. On page 28 of the slip opinion, the Chief Justice wrote, indeed, the Solicitor General candidly acknowledged that the tax exemptions of some religious institutions would be in question if they opposed same-sex marriage. There is little doubt that these and similar questions will soon be before this court. Are you suggesting, and I hope you are, that in 3 or 4 years' time, with perhaps a reconstituted court under Republican president, that there might be a case where they would walk away, or walk back at least a little, from today's opinion in Obergefell?
Well, I hope, but I'm not sure it's going to be that long. Those cases are already coming. We've seen them in a number of contexts with the state's public accommodations laws, which are treated as laws of general applicability. And therefore, even though they create an undue burden on religious exercise, the free exercise of religion clause provides no protection against those laws of general applicability. And so, you know, once you walk outside your synagogue or the privacy of your own home, the general rule is now becoming you don't get to exercise your religion if it means excluding people whose conduct you disagree with. You can hold that belief as long as you keep it private. And now, hopefully, by the time the case has reached the Supreme Court, there will be a different dynamic there. But right now, I see five votes to uphold the IRS decision to revoke the tax-exempt status of a university that says married student housing means married in accordance with our religious faith. Very public accommodation that would and their views on this are now by definition contrary to the established public policy of the Supreme Court, and therefore we don't give tax-exempt status to people that violate public policy. I can see these coming very quickly.
But if the court a little further out had a different composition, do you think that despite deference to stare decisis that we still might hope for a walk back from today's decision?
Well, I would hope so, but I remind people that the justice that wrote the Employment Division versus Smith case that kind of really weakened the religious exercise protections of the First Amendment. This is why we had to resort to RFRA for the Hobby Lobby case. The justice that wrote that is Antonin Scalia. And so these all flow from that weakening of the religious free exercise of religion clause that come about in Employment Division versus Smith. So it may not just be, you know, a Justice Kennedy or Justice Ginsburg that has to be replaced in order to have a different outcome on some of those things. These are very nerve-wracking times for religious liberty, it seems to me.
We've still got three questions pending, so let's take another call now.
Thank you very much. This is Sylvia Ross from Virginia, and my question really has to do with public education, the impact of this decision on K-12, because in Virginia, there is what's known as family life curriculum, and it's tied statutorily to the definition of family. So if family changes, and we can make it any combination we want, now children are subject to being taught that, and how does this impact parents? How does this impact the local school? I mean, any sort of comment on it would be appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, and we don't have to speculate about this. We've already got some the history on this. We've seen what's happened in Massachusetts in the 10 or 12 years since they redefined marriage by judicial imposition there. And the curriculums now are full of it's not just that homosexuality should be tolerated, but it is fully on a par with heterosexual relationships. And that if you disagree with that, that you are kind of espousing bigoted views. We've seen it happen in Canada, which is also about a decade ahead of our national ruling here, where parents at schools objected to the overtly pro-homosexual curriculum that was being taught to their children without their knowledge or consent. And when they found out about it, they objected, and the parents were said they had no say in that. And it's, you know, once you've defined something as a constitutional right, then those kind of objections seem relatively weak in comparison. And so I suspect the curriculum in Virginia will change rather radically, just as it has in these other jurisdictions that are a little bit ahead of the curve on this issue. And quite frankly, I think that will be immensely destructive to our social fabric. Those that have said that this is not going to have any effect on the institution of marriage and the family are either naive or deliberately misleading, because the notion that you can take an institution that is designed around that unique biological complementarity of men and women, whose purpose is to create the stability in the institution for the children that result from that and only that kind of sexual union, and you change all that and say none of that matters anymore to the institution, the notion that our cultural institutions and norms are not going to be profoundly affected, and the benefits that society has derived from those cultural norms are not going to be profoundly impacted, I think is just naive.
Moving right along.
Hello, this is John Meyer. And I first want to follow up on that Virginia thing. In the Fairfax schools, they're already planning to bring in a curriculum where there's no difference between, there's really no such thing as a girl and a boy. This is the transgender thing. They're actually ahead. But my actual question was, it does seem to me that there's one line that might logically be defended. It has to do with polygamy. If marriage is not defined as between a man and a woman, but is between two, which they haven't changed yet, then polygamy, there would be an actual logical reason for cutting off the polygamy route. And at least not going there. So what does everybody think?
Yeah, I wish that were the case. And I can certainly, you know, it's kind of like saying, well, we regulate interstate railroads, but we don't regulate interstate trucks because one are trains and the others are trucks. In logic, in fact, the biological diversity in the institution of marriage was much more profoundly connected to the purposes of marriage than the numerosity limitations on marriage. And so if you look at any measure, that it's an easier case to challenge the polygamy restrictions because they don't necessarily go to the essence of the institution, and there is a much longer historical basis for polygamy, not in Western society, but in other societies around the world. No such society ever had removed the gender component of marriage. So yes, I can say, well, I can just as a matter of raw will say, well, two is an important restriction, whereas gender is not. But in logic and reason, that makes no sense to me. And therefore, I think if the distinction makes no sense, it will fall unless we revisit the original question, where the distinction made an immense amount of sense because it was tied to our human natures. And we've now rejected human nature. So whatever goes will go. If the model is what makes you feel good, how you fulfill your love, how you feel, express your self-autonomy, and these are the language and the phrases out of Justice Kennedy's opinion, that's what defines a new fundamental right. I don't know how the restriction on two, that somebody that wants to have three, can have their autonomy restricted any more than two men could have their autonomy restricted under his own reasoning. Other than if he just says, well, I'm not, it's a matter of my own will, I don't think that's as important. Well, but that's not a reason. That demonstrates the fallacy of his opinion here, which is an exercise of real will rather than legal and constitutional judgment, and therefore an usurpation of the authority that had been given to him by Article 3 of the Constitution.
We've still got a few questions pending. Let's try and get to as many as possible. I know we have a hard stop here at the top of the hour. So.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth. I'm an attorney from Texas, and I have a question about your insistence that the original purpose of marriage is tied to our biology. I don't see that we have ever, as a state, told heterosexual couples that if they're infertile or don't intend to have children, that they can't get married, or that they can't even apply for a license, or can't file joint tax returns, or that if they don't have children by a certain date, we're going to withdraw what you call our approval. So I'm just really curious as to how you see this request as asking for the state's approval on the validity of your relationship instead of just an equity and rights, since none of the federal benefits sought, i.e. tax returns, intestacy, et cetera, are dependent on biological reproduction.
Right. Well, I suppose we could make it more directly tied. We could create a board of overseers and inspect the bedrooms, you know, weekly or monthly to make sure you're having sexual relations and are productive. We've, I think, made the decision that would be too great an intrusion on privacy to tolerate. And we don't create social institutions based on every instance of the example, but on the broad average or the broad run of cases. And it is simply a fact that in the broad run of cases, a man and a woman engaging in sexual relations are quite likely to be able to generate children, and it's that institution that we try and create to stabilize that relationship for the benefit of those children. The fact that there are others who are incapable of that at the margins doesn't alter our understanding of the institution. If I now redefine the institution to be about same-sex couples, where that's by definition not true, I've now in law and definition made the institution about something else, and that will have an impact in a way that issuing a marriage license to a couple that, you know, privately we might know to be infertile wouldn't alter the institution. I think that's the big difference. And by the way, it's also not true. We've long had in the common law dating back centuries a requirement of marriage that it be consummated before it become valid or what have you. So there is a greater tie to that than many people have been willing to accept.
All right. We are just about out of time here. I'm going to check the time really quickly. I know you have a hard stop at 3 o'clock Eastern, Professor Eastman, so I think we're going to have to let that be the final word, unless you have a 30-second final thought.
Well, I encourage people to look for the legal analysis in Justice Kennedy's opinion, and however you would like the outcome to have been on the question of same-sex marriage. I think the gentleman who posted saying that he said as a matter of policy, if he were a legislator or a voter at a referendum, he would have voted to redefine marriage to include same-sex relationships, but there's no constitutional authority for the court to impose this. And I think that question ought to be asking people on both sides of this debate, what is the proper role of the judiciary, and are we really willing to let unelected judges decide such profoundly important policy judgments as the one that's presented here? And if we are, what does that mean for our kind of democratic republican form of government? Thank you all, and thanks for Federalist Society for hosting me. I know these are my views and not necessarily those of the Federalist Society, and I appreciate your indulgence.
Of course. Thank you very much, Professor Eastman. And in his absence, I will thank Ilya Shapiro as well. It's been a very interesting call. A reminder to our audience that there are more cases coming on Monday, and there are cases that have been decided that we haven't yet covered through teleform. So check our website, monitor your emails for upcoming calls. It's a fluid schedule next week. But until that next teleform conference call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.